Let me just make sure that this is working. Do you hear music?
Yes.
Yep.
All that music.
Kick it!
Oh, yeah.
So we did this poll, and the poll asked people, how old were you when you fell in love with music? When's the music that you really loved, how old were you when that happened? And fairly predictably, it's like between the ages of 13 and 18. No surprise there. Somewhat fairly predictably, the favorite music that people liked was in the 1960s and the late 1960s. But the biggest surprise was that of all of the years picked, and if you looked at the decades, the 70s, you can do this online at the, in the All Songs Considered blog, almost nobody picked any year in the 1980s to be their favorite year for music. It means that all the people who were, coming of age, like Robin Hilton, who's here, producer of All Songs Considered, Stephen Thompson, who's here, editor for Song of the Day, and Carrie Brownstein, who's the writer for Monitor to Mix, who's in Portland. Hello, everybody.
Hey, Bob.
Hello, Bob.
Hello.
None of those people, and you guys are of this age, who came of age in the 80s, picked the 1980s. So the question to start with, were the 80s that bad?
Yes. This is Robin. If you had asked me at the time when I was going through it, I would have just said everything was just awful. Everything that I heard on the radio, I should say. And I still don't, there's not much about the 80s that I like today. But in retrospect, there's been quite a bit of stuff that I've heard, that I've gone back to, and I've realized, okay, you know, actually that's pretty good. That's not that bad. Okay. Or I've heard songs covered, you know, redone by other artists, and realized that's a pretty good song.
Stephen Thompson. 1980s, when you were in the 1980s, in the middle of it.
Yeah, I think it's important for each of us. I mean, we can all tell our ages, right?
Yeah.
Robin, how old are you?
I'm 39.
Carrie, how old are you?
33.
I'm 36. So we have a nice cross section.
So 33, Carrie, you were in 1985. You would have been
11.
11. So you were more the end of the 80s when you came of age.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, when you're young, the 80s are great. You know, Madonna is awesome. In 1985, she was my first concert. I don't feel any shame, any shame about that.
So
come
what
on,
would
you guys?
So what was so? Why? So
do I sound like a whiny 80s kid?
So why do you think it is that almost nobody picked the 1980s? Stephen Thompson.
Well, I don't know. I mean, pick an iconic moment in music history that happened in the 80s. I mean, people are more likely, I think, for one thing, you only get to pick one. So people, I think, are going to gravitate toward major cultural events, whether it's the birth of punk. You know, you might say, oh, 1977 was the best year for music. But I'm not sure that the 80s, that any given year in the 80s screamed, this is it.
An iconic moment.
An iconic moment.
Okay, so Carrie, what was it that was so bad?
I'll tell you why I think it was bad. It was because the 80s was like a buffet. So you walk into this buffet, and there's all these options, and there's this appearance of greatness. I am going to feel full at the end of the cornucopia of music. Hair metal, butt rock, pop music.
Did you just say butt rock?
Yes, a friend of mine just reintroduced me to that word, and I remembered, oh my God, that's part of the reason that it's bad. The fact that we could describe music from the 80s as butt rock. Could we just end the program?
I wish I'd heard that one earlier.
I did not.
That would have really come in handy.
Who would fit the butt rock?
We got Warrant's Cherry Pie. We have Cinderella. We have Poison. We have Motley Crue exiting their Shout at the Devil phase and going right into their, you know, Theater of Pain phase.
Skid Row,
Sebastian Bach. Yeah. So that to me, that music. Like Warrant's Cherry Pie, I don't care how many times you sing that at karaoke, it's never going to be a good song. Great White is never going to be a good band. And that, to me, that is, looking back, is what makes me cringe, the thought that I bought some of those cassettes.
Or ka-singles.
Or ka-singles, so.
Boy, I can pick a bad one without
Robin,
batting an eye.
I brought some bad stuff. I think Robin should take this, though.
Well, actually, Stephen and I were just talking about this one earlier, and I thought her name was Denise Williams, but it's actually
no, it's Denise
Williams.
Let's hear it for the boy.
Absolutely. Let's hear it for the boy. Because one of the problems I had with the 80s was the production of the music. And I think it's all captured on this track.
Okay, let's go for it. All mics are being left open here, folks. Chime in at will.
Okay, great movie, by the way. This is from Footloose.
Wow.
Man.
I can actually hear the other people in this conversation cringing.
Because there's no where is the bass on this song?
It's the synth. Everything's synth. That was one of the problems.
All right, let's play another one.
Another, well,
it's Stephen's choice.
Okay.
Oh, how mean do I want to be? Oh,
come on. You,
all right,
right
play Wild Wild West.
All right, hang on.
Oh, man.
It's just an atrocity.
What a trip.
I just worked out to this song the other day.
Well, wait, you have an instructor or a trainer, right? Were they picking the music or were you?
They picked it. He did a whole
was this part of was this part of feeling the pain?
Yes, we'll feel it right now when you play it too.
You hear the exact same thing I was talking about in the drums, you know?
Yeah.
This also sounds like the intro for Pretty Fly for a White Guy, which makes me want to shoot someone.
How far do we need to get?
We can stop any time.
Get ready, Robin, to pick another one.
Wow, another bad one.
This is Elvis Cut. This is Pump It Up.
Oh, yeah, it's absolutely rips off Pump It Up. But makes it terrible.
Pump It Up is a good song.
Yeah, but this makes it bad.
Okay, go for it, Hilton.
We were talking yesterday about Hall & Oates, and it's just one of the greatest musical mysteries to me that they ever got to be as popular as they were. And
Blue-Eyed Soul.
Oh, my gosh. They had
so many hits.
And I was just going to say, yeah, they had so many hits. I was just going down the list, and I actually don't have any of these. We can pop one in later if you want. I was going to say, I have like Private Eye.
All you got to do is tell me.
Man Eater.
Tell me Method of Modern Love.
Your Kiss. You make a my dreams come true. You make a my dreams come true. Can't go for that. I mean,
the songs are so catchy that they've actually started to register as, I don't think of those as terrible songs.
Really? Really? Yeah.
Really? Really, Steven? You would put that on a mix CD for your wife.
Know, okay, let's not call it, I won't call it terrible.
This
but
is not, by the way, the last time I say something incredibly embarrassing in this conversation.
I'm not going to call it any of those terrible, but just super, super, super cheesy. Just
well, they're
so
very
kitschy.
Catchy. They're very great. They can be very grating.
And I don't know, let's hear, I'm trying to think of one of, which if we wanted to hear one of those, let's do You Make My Dreams Come True.
Okay. While we're waiting for it to load, I work with a fellow who I love dearly, and Jim Hintze, if you're out there, I really loved working with you. But Jim would do the high parts along with the song and kind of get the body language too.
Wow.
It's just so...
Okay, so we've played a bunch of stuff here, and there's a common thread that we're all kind of cringing at, right? And the common thread seems to be bad synthesizers.
Yeah.
The curse of this time for me was, as a synth player, electronic musician, actually in a band in the 80s playing electronic music at the top of the 80s. So this was a painful sore subject for me, which was Yamaha invented an instrument called the DX7. The DX7 made it onto every single record in the universe. It was also a time when digital reverb came of age, and it was used on every single song. So, Stephen, pick me another song, and I bet you, without any question, that one of those will be.
I don't know how mean I want to be.
Stephen? You've been working up to this, and you're asking me how...
You guys are wimping out.
I seriously think a prize should be given to listeners who get through this entire discussion.
Well, you know, I will say, being a wimp, every time I've opened my mouth about this subject, I'm just firebombed with email from people who love the 80s, and in blog posts or in any other discussion. So it makes me a little gun-shy to be too harsh on something.
Well, I think the nostalgia for some of this stuff was just instantaneous. Yeah. I was a college radio music director in the early 90s, and we would throw 80s dances in 1992, 1993. And it was like the nostalgia wave kicked in instantly. And so I think for a lot of people, there's this sort of like, oh man, remember leg warmers? And I think it kind of ties in with that.
I wonder how many people are hearing these songs and go, oh yeah, man, what a great song. Or are they thinking...
Would you write to us at allsongs@npr.org?
Or are they thinking, I remember the... whatever high school Christmas dance I was at.
People like to feel a little bit of embarrassment with this stuff too. Like, oh man, I totally bought the 45 of that. I mean, I've got some stuff in here that
Pick me one. We'll see if there's reverb and synth.
Oh, okay. Yes. To finish Bob's point, let's play Heartbeat by Don Johnson.
Okay.
Wow.
That's like the nuclear option.
Oh, no reverb on that.
That's natural. And is this Don Johnson, Miami Vice?
Yes.
Don Johnson?
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. I don't care what you say. You can give it away.
Your money don't mean much to me. Stephen, I have my hand on the fader. Is it okay if I...
Oh, God, please. You do owe it to yourself to watch the video, to find the video for this song on YouTube, because it is hilarious.
Now, this is a secret. I think I've told Robin that this week, but I worked at a television station for a while, and I produced a music video show for about a year and a half in the 1980s. It was Captain Fogel's something or other. I can't remember. And I was Dr. Bob.
You didn't tell me that part.
that part's been a secret all my life. And they were the worst videos in the world.
Oh, it's hilarious.
Well, it's
okay, go ahead,
Carrie. No.
I was going to say, I just came up with a theory. So we're talking about nostalgia, and we're talking about how everyone has a soft spot. Many people have a soft spot for this music. But I feel like we can only look at it in relation to the decades that came before and after. So we give the 80s this wide berth to be embarrassing, to be flagrant, to sound awful, because we know now what came next, which was grunge, which was this power of Nirvana or Soundgarden. We know what came before it. So we give this, we allow ourselves that feeling of vicarious embarrassment or that feeling of nostalgia or sentimentality, because it just was a succinct period in our lives. Don't you think that if we continued on with the 80s, if everything sounded like Don Johnson or Don Henley solo,
Toto's Roseanne,
yes, that we would probably not be here today. We would all, I don't know where we would be, but I mean, I feel like I can allow myself the pleasure of dancing to the Denise Williams song when you played it in my seat a little bit, because I thought, well, I've moved on from Denise Williams.
When I think of the 80s, I think of it as a decade of excess. And Bob and I were talking about this earlier, and where everything was exaggerated, and you saw it in clothes, in fashion, hairstyles. And hairstyles, definitely hairstyles. You know, the whole palette was very exaggerated in movies. And it's only natural, I think, for that to spill over into popular music. And I think what we heard in the production of popular music, it was all very over the top. You know, there was no restraint. The editor was not on duty. And at all.
The editor was on cocaine.
Or something. And I think that's how you end up with a song like Let's Hear It for the Boy, which I heard covered recently by Dove Man.
And I
actually thought, wow, that's actually a very lovely little melody when it's tamed down, when it's stripped down. And
I worked around recording studios at that time, and one of the things that happened a lot was that engineers took control of the bands, and so you'd have, you know, that whole idea of an isolation chamber. So, okay, let's lay down the rhythm track. And then they spent, you know, 4 hours just getting the snare drum sound. And then the rest of the band was falling asleep. And then they'd bring in the rest of the band at 2 a.m. and say, okay, let's put the guitar down now. And so you had this music being produced in a very...
bloodless.
Bloodless is good. I wasn't thinking that. I like that. But very separate, detached way. And And the technology, which was actually fairly incredible for the time, you know, this whole reverb thing, which really different. You can be able to control not only just the overall, like, sound. It wasn't tied to the room you were in, but you can make any sound you want for any instrument. So the drum could have one reverb and the guitar another. Unfortunately, big was usually the size of them, but it was very engineer-controlled. And I think it took a long while for the novelty of the people who had the power, the people who had the faders in their hands and all that, to actually just say, you know, maybe this stuff isn't so good.
Yeah, we've got new toys. And
right.
Yeah, they hadn't learned how to finesse it yet. There are I've heard, you know, now we hear vintage synths in a lot of bands, and we think, oh, it's really cool the way they're using it. There's some restraint to it.
One thing that that comes to mind when I think of the 80s is formerly respected, you know, quality players turning a corner and doing something really embarrassing in the 80s. So you have somebody like Ozzy Osbourne, obviously of Black Sabbath, a great band. Lita Ford, you know, from the Runaways, pretty decent band, but both with a, you know, strong history of like solid riffage and rock music. And they come together in the 80s to create a vomitous duet called, I think,
Close My Eyes.
And again, you know, using the worst production value and just demeaning themselves and pretty much erasing all credibility that they had up until that point. Same with, I mean, not a huge Eagles fan, but you have all the Eagles going solo in the 80s. Glenn Frey, Don Henley producing, you know, an album with a song like Dirty Laundry on it, or Glenn Frey's Sexy Girl, you know, just completely eradicating anything good they did. Genesis, I mean, everyone just took a nosedive.
What do you think of the 80s?
If you recall, though, I mean, when Don Henley was putting out those records, those were hugely critically acclaimed. People loved that Building the Perfect Beast record. It was like album of the year.
Is there anyone in the 1980s who actually put out a record of the 80s that was better than the record they put out in the 70s?
Oh, that's a good question.
That's a good question.
Because I tried.
Falco.
I couldn't think of a one.
I was
anybody
watching.
Anybody out there who knows the answer to that one?
The Go-Betweens, you know, their 1979 work was not as great as some of their early 80s work, but we can get into the good bands later.
Yeah, I think before we get into the good bands, we should probably address where we grew up. Because looking at Carrie Brownstein's list versus looking at my list, it's pretty telling who had access to college radio and who didn't.
Yeah, Stephen and I, but I don't mean to speak for you, Steve.
Please do.
Well, no, Stephen and I both grew up in rural areas in the Midwest. Well, I was in the Great Plains, Midwest, and
Thank you for clarifying, because Kansas is not in the Midwest.
Yes, I grew up in the Great Plains, and Steve in the Midwest. But you know, when I saw Carrie's list, which had some great bands like, you know, Bush Tetris and
the Replacements,
Dead Kennedys, The Church. I didn't hear any of these bands on the radio when I was growing up. I heard, well, The Church had one. I heard Under the Milky Way. I heard that one big hit.
So I don't want anybody out there to think that between the ages of 11 and 13 that my parents flew me to England and I went to a record shop in Leeds and discovered the Delta 5.
Oh. And I have to say how sorry you... I mean, I got to see them, and I'm only because of age, not because I was any cooler. I wasn't an 11-year-old sneaking out to the 930 Club, but... the Bush Tetras and the Delta 5 I did see.
I saw the band Survivor at the Brown County Arena in Green Bay.
Well, I saw New Kids on the Block at the Puyallup Fair. So.
They were in that video show I did. That's how I know them.
I wanted to say something about something Carrie brought up about artists in the 80s whose IQs seemed to go into remission or something. Who did some of their worst work in the 80s. Just the other night, I was watching High Fidelity, the movie, and I'd forgotten how hilarious it was. And, you know, they're hanging out in the record store, and they're always asking each other to make lists of the best this or the worst that. And one of them was Stevie Wonder's Top 10 Crimes of the 80s. And it got me thinking exactly what you were saying, Carrie, that there were these artists who'd been great, and then something happened in the 80s. And Bruce Springsteen, I thought, was one, too, who had done some really wonderful stuff. And then, but the first time I really heard him as a young teenager was Born in the USA.
Oh, I love that record.
Really?
Yeah.
Mm, wow.
You're so wrong.
And when you heard Born in the USA, had you heard what came before?
No.
Okay. I think that's part of your point, Robin.
It is, and I didn't really start paying closer attention to him until the early 90s when he did a couple songs for some movies. He did a song for Philadelphia and Dead Man Walking. He did the album Ghost of Tom Joad. And I thought, you know, this stuff is really, really good. And it made me go back and start discovering some of his earlier recordings, like Nebraska.
But even you listen to his production, you know.
In the 80s,
In the 80s, and it was full of that kind of...
Boy, I wish we'd
spiky
pulled,
super synth.
I wish we'd pulled some of that out because at least I remember those. Like
which song did you want to hear?
Let's hear "Brilliant Disguise" from "Tunnel of Love."
Is that,
it's got a little bit of that Jeff Lynne, that kind of spangly Jeff Lynne production to it. But
yeah, and I wouldn't even insult Jeff Lynne that much.
Spangly is a good word for it, I think, particularly for that synth song.
I still love that song. I think it's a great song.
Even Queen, who all through the 70s would put on their records no synthesizers, you know? Even Queen broke down in the 80s and used synthesizers on their records. It was almost a disease. It was almost a cancer on the music of the entire 1980s, and I think we've been in remission.
Yeah, it really was in retrospect what I think ruined a lot of the music or spoiled a lot of the music for me.
Okay, so there was great music in the 1980s. Carrie Brownstein, play me something to wash the synth away.
All right, I think the best way to do that would be the Replacements, who put out probably one of the best records in the 80s. And this song is "I Will Dare."
So it's a very different sound. It's not quite as clean.
I love that. Yeah. What year, Carrie, do you know what year that was?
That was before Tim, right? What album is I Will Dare on? Is it on that?
It's on Let It Be, right?
Let It Be. Let It Be must be 84, and then Tim is next. Again, we're talking about how the excess production on a lot of the 80s albums took away from any underlying melody or sentiment or lyrical value in the song, and then you have a band like the Replacements that just sounds stripped down, and Paul Westerberg is singing with this slight affect of boredom or disenchantment, and that's probably tapping into what most people were actually feeling, and it just sounds like a breath of fresh air coming after some of the ridiculousness we've been listening to for the last 20 minutes. And this album is an album, again, what stands up over time from the 80s. The Replacements, for sure, especially their albums Let It Be and Tim, can stand up against any great album from previous decades or subsequent decades, which I think is a good measurement of it just being good music.
I think you have to mention that you have to mention R.E.M. They were doing incredible things, and they're a band like the others. I wasn't hearing at the time; I discovered them later.
That was a huge gateway band for me.
Yeah,
like a gateway into like music that was really great and sort of thoughtful and weird and required a little bit of you'd try to sort of pick Michael Stipe's brain, you know, while you were listening to it, and it was just a completely different listening experience than I was used to listening to pop radio in the early and mid 80s.
Very similar production to the Replacements we were just hearing too, and I also think they hold up
Oh, absolutely.
Against anything before or since.
And both of those bands have a thread that come out of the punk movement that you know had stripped away things that were happening in the 1970s. A lot of people loved music in the 1970s, but it got big, you know, and the whole reaction told many times of the reason punk actually even happened was because people were sick of the big. But Replacements straight line back to late 1970s. REM obviously a straight line because they were there in the late 1970s.
My parents, bless their hearts, bought me a subscription to Billboard magazine.
You're the only person I know who...
In the mid-80s. I subscribed. Amazing. I was like
the
youngest.
You were like 10 or something.
And
when
that
you
wasn't
got
like
it
a $19 subscription.
No, it was like a $400 subscription. We were not wealthy. I don't know what got into them. My parents definitely nurtured obsessions really, really well, but enough about me. But I remember in like 1986, I was riding my bicycle down the street and was trying to ride my bicycle and read Billboard magazine at the same time and careened into the back of a parked car.
Oh. And that's why you hate the 80s music.
And that, no. But, you know, I think, you know.
Can I just ask you, is this one of the tunes that you really really liked?
We built this song.
I was just wondering.
It's a running gag in the office that anytime somebody has a song stuck in their head, I'll employ the nuclear option of singing that song.
Do you just say,
we built this song. Yeah, we built this song.
What was the magazine that picked that as the worst?
Blender,
yeah.
It's the worst song of the 80s. It really is. That is the worst song of the 80s, in part because it's so unbelievably self-important. Like, on top of being of just being brutally catchy in an incredibly ugly way, that song thinks it's just awesome.
Oh, me. I recognize my face. Say you don't care who goes to that kind of place.
What are you doing?
I'm not a young man anymore, Bob.
You were going to play one of your favorites.
where do I go with this? I'm looking over the list. I mean, talking about sort of gateway records, this is a little bit late in the 80s. I think this is 1988. But the first Tracy Chapman record, I remember really jumping out at me as this incredible breath of fresh air record. It's definitely got a few flourishes of 80s production, but it's so much more stripped down. And I remember that, for me, not only being a gateway record into, you know, the future of a lot of sort of folk-inspired, you know, pop music, but also a gateway back, you know, to dig up, you know, Joni Mitchell records and stuff like that, which, you know, I wasn't hearing on pop radio and sort of Tracy Chapman was kind of a gateway into older folk music that I learned to really love.
Good. What do you want to hear?
Play. I mean, the big hit was Fast Car, and I think it's just a brilliant song.
Okay.
You could not have picked anything more opposite.
Sorry, Tracy.
You get a fast car. I want a ticket to anywhere. Maybe we make a deal. Maybe together we can get somewhere. Any place is better. Starting from zero, got nothing to lose. Maybe we'll make something. Me, myself, I got nothing to prove. You get a fast car. I got a plan to get us out of here. Been working at the convenience store. Managed to save just a little bit of money. Won't have to drive too far. Just cross the border and into the city. You and I can both get jobs and finally see what it means to be living.
It's great.
It is an absolutely incredible song. It's a portrait of people's lives. And it was a huge pop hit. And, you know, I was what, 15 or 16 when that song came out. And I just wasn't used to hearing songs. That song tells, it's a complete portrait of a really complicated relationship.
It really resonated with me when it came out. I had in this, you know, we talk about where, at what point in your life were you when you heard these songs? And I came from a small town, and I had just graduated from high school. The road leading to the rest of my life lay ahead of me, and here came this song that really captured everything that I was feeling at the time.
It wasn't Little Pink Houses.
No.
Jack and Diane. There's a portrait of that.
I think something else that Fast Car illustrates, and I think drawing a parallel to somebody, a band so unlike Tracy Chapman, but Guns N' Roses, which was, there's these few spots, bright spots in the 80s where people kept referring to something that I didn't even really understand at the time. I remember Guns N' Roses came out and my dad said, oh, this is the band that's supposed to save music. They're just going back to playing guitar, just being a regular band playing guitar, which, you know, I guess looking back, yeah, they were. And Tracy Chapman, a lot of people, you know, have that sound today. Maybe not. I mean, she's a very unique singer and musician, but certainly that stripped down folk sound is something that's much more lauded today or in the 90s. But at the time, the earnestness, like the fact that something was able to actually be surprising by being stripped down was novel at the time. And I think both Guns N' Roses, strangely, and Tracy Chapman are examples of people that it was so strange that, you know, anyone was just getting into a studio with some guitar and, you know, with Guns N' Roses, some drums and bass.
I hear that.
I also actually, on the topic of Guns N' Roses, and you know, we were talking earlier about bigness, and how, you know, Guns N' Roses managed bigness in a way that seemed so much more authentic than a lot of what had come before. And I actually had I'd pulled out Paradise City if you wanna hit that.
Sure, I'll give that up.
Such a great song.
It's the logical follow up to Tracy Chapman.
You know, this was the very late 80s, and I was hearing something. I started hearing things on the radio in the very late 80s that made me think things are starting to change. Okay. And this was definitely one of them, yeah. Yep. Man, do not stop this song.
Seriously.
Man.
Bob, you don't even have to do your job from here on out. Just let it play.
It's so painful to me.
How is this painful to you? This song is so great.
This is just rock and roll. This is just rock and roll.
This has lost nothing. It's still going to get better.
It's not even at the fast part yet.
That's right.
He's just getting off the bus on the video.
You guys are just shaking your head.
I'm getting on a plane to DC right now. We're just going to sit around and listen to the GNR for the rest of the day.
You know, when this came out, I had spent the entire 80s, my whole shtick with my circle of friends was that I was the cranky one who hated all the music that was coming. And this was, you know, I graduated from high school already, but it was still the 80s, and I had spent the past however many years hating all the music I heard. And then this came out, and I loved it, but I couldn't tell anybody that. And so I would drive around and listen to this album with the windows up on the car and the volume up so no one knew what I was listening to. I would never admit it to it, but I loved it, and I think it totally holds up. That's great music.
I'm still trying to come down from the joy of listening to that.
Yeah, that was great.
You're so mad at us, Bob.
I'm still your friend, and I love you both, and I still hope you love me, too.
Carrie, you can't see the disappointment in Bob's face.
Stephen and I were just bobbing our heads the whole time, and Bob was shaking his head
like
back and forth.
At the Beavis and Butthead set. Robin had his fingers up in the air. I think it was the pinky and the index one.
I actually have some songs that from the 80s that still have the same production values that we were talking about before, but I thought worked and I really loved.
Yeah.
And one of them was Head Over Heels by Tears for Fears.
I'm not going to get a palate cleanser at all.
it's a great
Carrie
song.
Helped me.
And a really talented band, too. And and it has everything. It's got the cheesy synths and the digital drums, but something about it works. It has this sweeping, epic...
It's grandeur.
It's really, really... when I hear the phase shifters in the drum fill that comes pretty late in it, I just thought, that is awesome. That is so awesome.
I picture Robin in a trench coat right now drinking a tab.
With my mullet.
I mean, I can't even get past the damn
You're
open
kidding.
Keyboard. He's making me.
Robin's holding up his index finger and telling Bob not to stop the song.
Gotta get to the solo.
I feel solo? It coming. It's not like
very soon.
Maybe the chorus?
Oh, the solo.
That is awesome.
I'm going to back Robin up on this. That's actually sounded better than I remember it.
Oh, great song. They had a lot of great songs, actually, but that's one that stands out. That Everything on Paper, by Everything on Paper, I should have hated that song, and I loved it.
On paper, it's We Built the City. It's a very big, sort of pompous...
Yeah.
Statement.
Yeah.
But
well, two things. If that, again, we talked about it earlier, if that song didn't have that cheesy production, I mean, the melody,
it was
a
nice
vocal
melody.
It's
Bob
a nice melody.
It.
Yeah. Okay.
But let's show off by naming the members of that band. We got
Roland Orzabal, Kurt Smith.
I think there were just two guys.
I can't hear that song without thinking of the video, and it's something we haven't talked about.
Yeah. Mm.
Is the importance of videos in the 80s and how much they changed music and our perception of music. And so many of the songs that I actually secretly did like in the 80s, I think of the video, and I think it's because of the video. Particularly where I grew up, and Stephen, I know it was the same for you, you had FM, Top 40 Radio, and MTV.
And MTV.
Go ahead, Carrie.
Oh, I was going to say, a perfect example of a band that's kind of tying a few things together we've talked about, Devo, whose video Whip It was huge and is such an iconic video from the 80s, but at the same time, not their best record, but a perfect way to be introduced to that band and then go back and realize that they actually had some not just decent albums, but great albums a few years prior to that. And not many bands fit into that category where their 80s music was huge, but also led you back down a path where it opened up something pretty amazing for you.
The Talking Heads, for some people, it was the 80s that brought them to them and went backwards too. I don't think they made better records in the 1980s than they did in the 70s, but they made good records. Can I play one song just because I need a change? I'm just going to play just a little musical. As you know. So it's not Tears for Fears.
Talking Heads covering We Built This City.
Just for a moment. Just give me a moment. That's all. I'm going to take some deep breaths.
restraint.
Tasteful, though.
I could play the whole. This must be the place of Talking Heads. Yeah. Should we just listen, David?
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Playing the whole 5 minutes.
You'll get no pushback from me on that. I mean, that's just indisputably great.
One kind of music that we haven't yet talked about much, I lived above a restaurant around the corner from the 930 Club at the point when a lot of the hardcore and straight edge music was being made. I think that that music is some of the music that still influences today and also looked backwards well. If I could play just a, because they're only 45 seconds long, cut from Minor Threat, the song Straight Edge.
I nearly had a myocardial infarction.
And they were incredibly intense when they did that stuff. I mean, it was so, I mean, obviously, they're just amazing, this Minor Threat.
How is that is different from punk? Is it just that it's a little muddier?
It was even more direct, if you could be more direct than, but if you listen to Sex Pistols in relation to Minor Threat, for example, there's almost guitar solos in the Sex Pistols relative to...
There's absolutely no posturing. Like no preening.
Uh-huh. Preening, yeah.
Yeah, I'm sure there's posturing.
preening is a good word. It's a good.
It starts at speed, it ends at speed.
Right.
And the structure, it's not an AB structure.
There are no flourishes.
Yeah. I'm here with Robin Hilton, the producer of All Songs Considered, Stephen Thompson, the editor for Song of the Day here at NPR, and Carrie Brownstein, the writer for Monitor Mix.
Which is a blog at NPR Music.
And a good one. You're a great writer.
But you're great, Carrie.
You are.
You guys
I
are
love
great.
You, man.
We think you're awesome.
Music from that time in the 80s that influences today or that holds up right?
Well, for one thing we haven't talked about is this whole idea of an underground that has disappeared a little bit in terms of technology kind of rising up. And I'm not saying it's bad that we don't have a sort of a differentiation between sort of mainstream and underground, because now everything can be seen sort of in the same glare of the internet. It's kind of the great equalizer. But certainly in the early 80s, I mean, you had all these pockets, all these small scenes across the country communicating via the bands that were touring with fanzines, or sometimes bands, small punk rock and hardcore bands that never actually left the East Coast corridor, or only toured from Los Angeles to Seattle. And that was in such contradiction to the grandiosity of the sort of 80s pop music. And I think that the spirit of that kind of underground music that was really antithetical to mainstream ideals, that really stripped down all pretense, that even sometimes removing melody from the songs. You know, that kind of desire to come crashing through, I think, is something that a lot of bands have tried to emulate, you know, to come out with something that just knocks you out. And it's getting harder and harder, but I think that drive to just harness something in your community and make music that really lights a fire under a scene is something from that time period that continues to this day, is something I think that bands strive for with various levels of success. But, you know, like Black Flag, I mean, they continue to be highly influential. And of course, Bad Brains, I think, is a band also from DC that people look back to all the time as progenitors of not only hardcore, but in their later music, you know, incorporating reggae and other styles, and bands that were able to kind of branch out. But I think people always look back to that kind of purist music as a way of just recalibrating their own, you know, sense of, like, when they start to feel like they're kind of drifting off into something that's a little too complicated. Like, you can always get back to something, like when you just played Straight Edge by Minor Threat. I mean, that just resets everything. You're like, okay, we'll start there. We'll start with Straight Edge, and then we'll move on to something else.
And all you had to do was see JR, see the Bad Brains perform, or see Minor Threat perform, or JR do his backflip while he's singing, and then go watch MTV, and you knew which one was visceral, that was life-changing. Well, I guess MTV was life-changing. I mean, I guess that's not a fair thing to say at all. When I saw both of them, for me, the way they hit me was, one was totally gut and made me want to do something, inspired, and the other was just wasn't that for me. For someone who grew up without music videos and then seeing music videos, there was objection to what it did to the listening experience. For someone who grew up with it, it was a fantastic and wonderful thing to see music come to life. I think they're both those things, actually, now in retrospect.
I think the videos also, I know they made me like songs that I don't think I would have liked otherwise, mm-hmm. because they were so entertaining to watch.
Yeah. Living For You, Stephen, in Wisconsin, and Robin in Kansas, probably your first. Hearing Peter Gabriel, for example, might have been on MTV, right?
Yeah, I mean, I remember thinking of him almost as like a multimedia artist, mm-hmm. because his videos were so, because his videos were so inventive.
And he was a multi. I mean, even in Genesis, he was a multimedia artist.
You know, so, you know, I definitely had thought of him, you know, as almost like videos first, mm-hmm. even though I heard his songs mm-hmm. on the radio all the time.
You know, as Bob talks about the difference in what was influential, the MTV, you know, 80s pop or the hardcore, some of these underground scenes, I think of the mainstream stuff as sort of this neon light that just burned throughout the 80s. But then, you know, surrounding that were all these small little fires that maybe never created anything larger than the communities they existed in. But certainly if you look at a place like New Zealand in the 80s and Flying Nun Records, I mean, if you go back, there's a handful of amazing bands, whether it's the Chills or the Clean or the Verlaines or the Bats or Tall Dwarves, all coming out of this scene, and they're all worth going back and checking out. And
you named five bands from New Zealand and did not name Crowded House. That makes me so sad.
Did you you want to play the Bats?
Sure.
Okay. The song we have is North by North.
I would rather listen to that than the Tears for Fears.
Now, I never heard this band.
This is great, and I actually hadn't either. And the whole time I was listening, I thought, there's nothing about... It's very timeless. There's nothing about this that sound that just screams 1980s to me at all.
Either they couldn't afford the high production reverbs, or they were tasteful.
But that was
exactly.
great.
Yeah, this is also a small town. I think a lot of it was Dunedin in New Zealand, but... I can't take credit for knowing this in the 80s. Just friends turned me on to this stuff in the 90s. And when I think of the 80s and when I try to justify, you know, or seek out what was good about it, I always turn to these little pockets of music, sometimes not even happening in the U.S., that really stand out as being exemplary.
Could you play, you pick either one, because we've mentioned Delta 5 and Bush Tetras. Both were amazing live bands. They talk about fires. They were an absolute flash.
They were a supernova.
They burned bright. They were amazing. And I think almost any female who went to these shows became a drummer after seeing either the Delta 5 or the Bush Tetras, both a remarkable groups. So let's play Too Many Creeps from Bush Tetras. They were one of those bands that were much more fierce when they played live. You could hear that kind of Gang of Four skanky sound that I quite loved in their guitar.
Yeah, I think a common thread that runs through a lot of what you've been playing here is these are not highly polished voices.
Yeah.
And, you know, you're not dealing with, I think in some cases, there aren't a lot of commercial stakes behind some of these recordings. So you don't necessarily have, you got to get, whatever the big producer was to throw on the synths and throw on the vocal sweeteners and whatever. These are bands that are playing music because they want to play music. And, and so the fact that they feel so much less polished also means that they feel a lot more timeless.
And I think it goes back to what Robin Hilton said about the Footloose and the Denise Williams, where we started at the top, which was...
And thus it all returns to Denise Williams.
It does. And how awful it may have been when you go back and listen to it now, but what a good song. It's the production that ruined.
I think, I'm not going to say that's the...
Am I paraphrasing you just exactly right?
I think if we come to one conclusion here today...
Yeah. No, I would never say it's a classic or anything like that, but it's just a song as many other songs that came out in the 80s, popular 80s songs. It's a song that, hearing it stripped down and hearing someone like Thomas Bartlett or Dove Man do it, I was able to hear the melody really for the first time, and I just, it became a very lovely little song and much more digestible than it was before. And he also made it more organic and more soulful too. You know, it was this very cold and sterile mechanical song created by machines in a studio before that were following a formula that had been programmed into them, and he turned it into something very heartfelt.
Good. Well, let's go out on that. Stephen Thompson, thank you so much. Robin Hilton, for your Footloose, and and we didn't bring up the fact that you were in an 80s cover band.
I was. Our band name was Xenon, which is the the inert gas, and we had t-shirts. The drummer's brother was a graphic artist, and we had t-shirts that said Xenon Inert Tour 84. The tour was of high school Christmas dance and a street party.
Please send photos. Please post photos.
That's right,
online.
On the blog. Carrie Brownstein, so good to talk to you again. We look forward. Maybe you'll want to say something about this madness in your writing about 80s music. and your blog, Monitor Mix. I'm Bob Boylan for NPR Music. It's All Songs Considered.
Baby, he don't talk sweet. He ain't got much to say. But he loves me, loves me, loves me. I know that he loves me anyway. Maybe he don't dress fine, but I don't really mind. Cause every time he pulls me near, I just wanna cheer. Let's hear it for the boy. Let's give
We're having a big discussion of Baltimora and Tarzan Boy the other day.
Wow. Yeah, that's a good one. What about, we didn't even do Rock Me Amadeus.
I did mention Falco. Take On Me. We talked about videos and did not mention Take On Me by A-ha, which
that
still,
was incredible
still
video.
Looks like a great, it's still a great looking video.
Yeah,
it still
that, seems
too
that
much
was
to cover. Good. We're going to get, people are going to.
We'll have all these letters like, dear idiots.
What about you too, Joshua Tree? Robin's right. They're going to talk about Joshua Tree.
Joshua Tree.
How about Chris Cross's Ride Like the Wind? Kenny Rogers, Coward of the County.
We didn't talk about Glass Tiger. We didn't talk about Concan. We didn't talk about The Outfield.
Oh, The Outfield.
Wow. What of the Georgia Satellites?
What about OMD?
I brought OMD just in case. I had If You Leave all queued up.
We didn't talk about John Hughes and his soundtracks in the 80s either.
No, we didn't mention Dead or Alive.
Wait, Bon Jovi?
No, Dead or Alive.
No,
you Spin Me Round Like a Rabbit.
Oh, God. I was thinking, wanted.
That's a good one, too.
Every time Howard Jones pops into my mind, I think, I bet Robin Hilton was a fan of Howard Jones.
I was. I really was.
What about Thomas Dolby? Did you like
it? I love it. I Have Blinded Me by Science was one of the songs I brought in.
Oh, and you brought in the Dream Academy, too. Life in a Northern Town is that's a great song.
I still get a little choked up.
Let's do a whole episode where we just try to make each other cry.
Stephen, I never liked you. Oh, wait, not that kind of... Stephen, you're...